as compassionately as possible. The file goes to the DPP, but on the quiet. Nothing's made publicly available, especially if we're not talking about a career criminal. We'd rather not wreck a man's name when he's not around to defend himself. If the DPP agrees that we'd have a good case, we have a chat with the victim's family, make it clear that nothing's definitive here, but we can at least give them a certain amount of closure. And that's the end of that. They get to move on, the killer's family get to keep their peace of mind, we get to mark the case solved. That'd be the normal procedure. I said, "Why do I get the feeling you're trying to threaten me?" "Oh, come on, Frank. That's a very dramatic way of putting it." "How would you put it?" "I'd say, I'm trying to warn you, and you're not making it easy."
"Warn me what, exactly?"
Scorcher sighed. "If I need to go for an in-depth inquest to determine Kevin's cause of death," he said, "I'll do it. And I'd be willing to bet the media will be all over it like a rash. Regardless of how you feel about the suicide issue, we both know one or two journos who like nothing better than a dodgy cop. And I think you can see how, in the wrong hands, this story could make you look dodgy as all hell." I said, "That sounds a lot like a threat to me." "I think I've made it pretty obvious that I'd rather not go down that road. But if this is the only way to make you stop playing boy detective..." "I'm just trying to get your attention, Frank. I haven't had much luck any other way." I said, "Think back, Scorcher. What was the one thing I told you last time we saw each other?" "That your brother wasn't the killer."
"That's right. And how much attention did you pay to that?"
The Scorcher flipped down the sun visor and checked a shaving cut in the mirror, tilting his head back to run a thumb along his jaw. "In some ways," he said, "I suppose I owe you a thank you. I've got to admit, I'm not sure I'd have found a Milda Tierney if you hadn't found her for me. And she's turning out very useful."
"The cunning little bitch."
"I bet she is. She's the obliging type, if you know what I mean." "Oh, no. She's not just trying to make me happy. Her evidence'll hold up, if it comes to that." He let it hang there. The tiny smirk he couldn't hide gave me the general idea, but I went along anyway. "Go on, then. Hit me. What's she come up with?" Scorch pursed up his lips, pretending to think about it. "She may end up being a witness, Frank. All depending. I can't tell you her evidence if you're going to try and harass her into changing it. I think we both know just how badly that could end, don't we?" I took my time. For a long, cold moment, I stared him out of it. Then I let my head fall back against the headrest and ran my hands over my face. "You know something, Scorch? This has been the longest week of my life." "I know that, old son. I'm hearing you. But, for everyone's sake, you're going to have to find somewhere more productive to direct that energy."
"You're right. I shouldn't have gone looking for Imelda to begin with. That was well out of order. I just figured... she and Rosie were close, you know. I thought, if anyone knew anything..."
"You should have given me her name. I'd have talked to her for you. Same end result. None of this hassle."
"Yes. You're right again. It's just... it's hard to let go when there's nothing definitive, one way or another, you know? I like knowing what's going on."
Scorch said dryly, "Last time we talked, you sounded pretty sure you knew exactly what was going on."
"I thought I did. I was positive. But now?"
I said, "I'm tired, Scorch. Over the past week I've dealt with dead exes, dead brothers, and a hefty dose of my parents, and I'm a very wrecked little puppy. Maybe that's what's doing it. I'm not positive about anything anymore. Nothing at all."
I could tell by the puffy look on Scorch's face that he was about to enlighten me, which was bound to put him in a better mood.
"Sooner or later, Frank," he told me, "we all end up getting a good kick in the certainties. That's what life is. The trick is to turn that kick into a stepping stone towards the next level of certainty. Do you get me?" This time, I swallowed my helping of tossed metaphor salad like a good boy.
"Yeah, I do. And I hate bloody admitting this, to you of all people. But I need a hand up to that next level. I really do, mate. Put me out of my misery. What's Imelda saying?"
"You're not going to give her grief about it."
"As far as I'm concerned, my life will be complete if I never see Imelda Tierney again.
I'm going to need your word on this, Frank. No dodging."
"I give you my word. I will not go near Imelda. Not about Kevin, not about Rosie, not about anything ever. No matter what. No matter what.
Believe me, I don't want to complicate your life. And I won't have to as long as you don't complicate mine. Don't force my hand here."
"I won't." Scorcher smoothed his hair into place and snapped the sun visor shut.
"In a way," he said, "you were right to go after Imelda. Your technique may suck, my friend, but your instincts are spot on."
"She knew something."
"She knew plenty. I've got a bit of a surprise for you, old son. I know you thought you and Rose Daly were keeping your relationship a big secret, but in my experience, when a woman says she won't tell a soul, what she means is she'll only tell her two very best friends. Imelda Tierney knew all along. The relationship, the plans to elope, everything."
"God," I said. I shook my head, did a shamefaced half-laugh, let Scorcher inflate with satisfaction.
"Right. She...
Wow. Now that I didn't see coming. You were only a kid. You didn't know the rules of the game."
"Still, hard to believe I was ever that naive.
Here's something else you may have missed. Imelda says Kevin had a massive thing for Rose way back when. You've got to admit that fits with what you've told me. She was the neighborhood babe, all the boys fancied her."
"Well, sure. Yeah. But Kevin, he was only 15.
"That's old enough for the hormones to be going bananas. And old enough to wangle his way into clubs where he shouldn't have been going."
One night, Imelda was in Brooksells, and Kevin came up to her and offered to buy her a drink. They got talking, and he asked her, begged her, to put in a good word for him, with Rose. That cracked Imelda up, but Kevin looked genuinely hurt, so once she stopped laughing, she told him it wasn't personal. Rose was taken. That was as far as she was planning to go, but Kevin kept pestering her about who the guy was, and he kept buying her more drink. Scorch was managing to keep his face grave, but he was having a great old time. Right under the surface, he was still that deodorant-drenched teenager, pumping his fist and hissing, "Score!" In the end, she spilled the whole thing. She didn't see any harm in it. She thought he was a lovely, sweet kid. Plus, she figured he'd back off once he knew they were talking about his own brother, right?
Wrong. He lost the plot, shouting, kicking walls, throwing glasses. The bouncers had to boot him out of the place.
Which would have been several miles out of character. When Kev lost his temper, the worst he ever did was flounce off in a huff. But apart from that, it all hung together just gorgeously. I was getting more impressed with Imelda by the minute. She was well up on the barter system. She had known before she ever called Scorcher that if she wanted to get him to get the nasty man off her street, she would have to give him something he wanted in exchange. Probably, she had rung around a few old friends to find out exactly what that might be. The murder boys had obviously made it clear, while they were doing their door-to-door, that they were interested in any link between Kevin and Rosie. The place would have had no trouble filling in the blanks. I suppose I should consider myself lucky that Imelda had been sharp enough to do her research, rather than just flying off the handle and dumping me in the firing line.
"Jesus," I said.
I leaned my arms on the steering wheel and slumped forward,
staring out through the windscreen at the traffic inching past the mouth of the laneway. Sweet Jesus. And I never had a clue. When was this?
Scorcher said, a couple of weeks before Rose died.
Imelda feels pretty guilty about the whole thing, now that she knows where it led. That's what made her come forward. She's going to give me an official statement as soon as we're finished here.
I just bet she was.
Well, I said, I guess that's evidence, all right.
I'm sorry, Frank.
I know.
Thanks.
I know this isn't what you were hoping to hear,
that's for sure.
But, like you said, any kind of certainty helps, even if that's not your perception right now. At least it means you've got some closure. When you're ready, you'll be able to start integrating all of this into your worldview.
Scorcher, I said, let me ask you something. Do you go to a shrink?
He managed to look embarrassed and self-righteous and belligerent all at once.
Yeah.
Why? Do you want a recommendation?
No, thanks. I was just wondering.
The guy's pretty good. He's helped me discover a lot of interesting things. How to bring my outer reality into sync with my inner reality, that kind of stuff.
Sounds very motivational.
It is. I think he could do a lot for you.
I'm an old-fashioned kind of guy. I still think my inner reality should get in sync with the outer one.
I'll keep the offer in mind, though.
Yeah, do that.
Scorcher gave my dashboard a manly pat, like it was a horse that had learned its lesson.
It's been good talking with you, Frank. I should probably get back to the grindstone. But give me a ring, any time, if you need a chat, yeah?
Will do. I reckon what I really need is some time by myself, though, to take all this in. It's a lot to absorb.
Scorch did a profound nod and eyebrows number that he had presumably picked up from his shrink.
I said, do you want a lift back to the squad?
No, thanks. The walk will do me good. Got to keep an eye on the old waistline.
He tapped his stomach.
Take care of yourself, Frank. We'll talk.
The laneway was narrow enough that he had to open the car door about 6 inches and wriggle his way out, which brought down the tone of his exit. But he got it back once he got into his murder squad stride. I watched him swing off through the tired, scurrying crowds, a man with a briefcase and a purpose, and remember the day, a few years back, when we had run into each other and discovered we had both joined the divorce club. The drinking session had lasted 14 hours, and had finished up in a UFO-themed joint in Bray, where Scorch and I tried to convince 2 brain-dead lovelies that we were Russian millionaires over here to buy Dublin Castle, except we kept losing it, and snickering helplessly into our pints like a pair of kids. It occurred to me that I had kind of liked Scorcher Kennedy for the last 20 years, and that I was actually going to miss him. People routinely underestimate me, and it's one of my favourite things. But all the same, I was a little surprised at Imelda. She didn't seem like the type to overlook the less fluffy side of human nature. In her place, I would at least have had a large, ugly friend with some form of weapon spend a few days with me. But on Thursday morning, the Tierney household appeared to be back to business as usual. Genevieve schlepped off to school sucking on a Kit Kat. Imelda headed for New Street and came back carrying 2 plastic bags. Isabel stalked off somewhere that called for pulled back hair and a sharp white shirt. There was no sign of any bodyguard, armed or otherwise. This time, no one saw me watching. Around noon, a couple of teenage girls with a couple of babies rang the buzzer. Shania came downstairs, and they all wandered off to window shop or shoplift or whatever. Once I was sure she wasn't going to come back for her smokes, I cracked the front door lock and went up to Imelda's flat. She had some talk show turned up loud, people howling at each other and the audience baying for blood. The door was crusted with locks, but when I put my eye to the crack, only one of them was actually on. It took me about 10 seconds to pick. The telly covered the sound of the door creaking open. Imelda was sitting on her sofa, wrapping Christmas presents, which would have been more adorable if it hadn't been for the TV show and the fact that most of them were fake Burberry. I had the door closed and I was coming up behind her when something, my shadow, a floorboard, made her whip around. She caught her breath to scream, but before she could get started, I had a hand over her mouth and the other forearm leaning across her wrists, pinning them down on her lap. I got comfortable on the arm of the sofa and said, close to her ear, "Imelda, Imelda, Imelda. And here you swore to me you weren't a squealer. I'm disappointed in you." She aimed an elbow at my stomach. When I tightened my hold, she tried to bite my hand. I pressed it down harder, pulling her head back, till her neck arched and I could feel her teeth crushing against her lip. I said, "When I take my hand away, I want you to think about two things. The first one is that I'm a whole lot closer than anyone else. The second one is what Deco upstairs would think if he knew there was an informer living here, because it would be very, very easy for him to find out. Do you think he'd take it out on you personally? Or would he decide Isabel's juicier? Or maybe Genevieve? You tell me, Imelda. I don't know what kind of taste he's got." Her eyes were lit up with pure fury, like a trapped animal's. If she could have bitten my throat out, she would have done it. I said, "So what's the plan? Are you going to scream?" After a moment, her muscles slowly loosened and she shook her head. I let go, tossed a bunch of Burberry off an armchair onto the floor, and settled in. "There," I said, "isn't this cozy?" Imelda rubbed tenderly at her jaw. "Prick," she said. "This wasn't my choice, babe, now was it? I gave you two separate chances to talk to me like a civilized person, but no, you wanted it this way. My fella'll be home any minute now. He does the security. You don't want to be messing with him." "That's funny, because he wasn't home last night, and there's nothing in the room that says he's ever existed." I kicked the Burberry out of the way so I could stretch out my legs. "Why would you lie about something like that, Imelda? Don't tell me you're afraid of me." She was sulking in the corner of the sofa, arms and legs crossed tight, but that got a rise out of her. "You wish, Frances Mackey. I've bet the shite out of a lot tougher than you." "Oh, I'm sure you have. And if you can't beat the shite out of them, you run and tell someone who might. You squelt on me to scorcher Kennedy. No, shut your bloody great gob and don't be trying to lie your way out. And I'm not one bit happy about it. But it's easily fixed. All you have to do is tell me who you ran to about me and Rosie, and hey presto, all will be forgiven." Imelda shrugged. In the background, the TV baboons were still belting each other with studio chairs. I leaned over, keeping a sharp eye on Imelda just in case, and yanked the plug out of the wall. Then I said, "I didn't hear you." Another shrug. I said, "I think I've been more than patient. But this right here, what you're looking at? This is the last of my patience, sweetheart. Take a good, long look. It's a whole lot prettier than what comes next." "So?" "So, I thought you'd been warned about me." I caught the flash of fear across her face. I said, "I know what they're saying around here. Which one do you think I killed, Imelda? Rosie or Kevin? Or is it both? I never said..." "See, I'm betting on Kevin. Am I right? I thought he killed Rosie, so I booted him out that window. Is that what you figured out?" Imelda had better sense than to answer. My voice was rising fast, but I didn't care if Deco and his drug buddies heard every word. I had been waiting all week for a chance to lose my temper like this. "Tell me this. How thick do you have to be? How incredibly stupid to play games with someone who would do that to his own brother? I'm in no mood to be fucked with, Imelda, and you spent yesterday afternoon fucking with me. Do you think that was a good idea? I just wanted..." And now here you are, doing it again. Are you deliberately trying to push me that extra inch? Do you want me to snap? Is that it? No.
I was up out of the armchair, gripping the sofa back on either side of her head, shoving my face so close to hers I could smell cheese and onion crisps on her breath.
Let me explain something, Imelda. I'll use small words so it'll get through your thick skull. Inside the next 10 minutes, I swear to Christ, you're gonna answer my question. I know you'd rather stick to the story you told Kennedy, but you don't have that option. Your only choice is whether you want to answer with a few slaps or without.
She tried to duck her head away from me, but I got one hand cupped around her jaw and forced her face up to mine.
And before you decide, think about this. How hard would it be for me to get carried away and wring your neck like a chicken's?
Everyone round here already thinks I'm Hannibal Lecter. What the hell have I got to lose? Maybe she was ready to talk by then, but I didn't give her a chance.
Your friend, Detective Kennedy, may not be my biggest fan, but he is a cop, just like me. If you turn up beaten to a pulp, or, God forbid, dead as a doornail, don't you think he's going to look after his own? Or do you seriously think he'll care more about some bone-stupid scanger tramp whose life wasn't worth a fiver to anyone in this world? He'll throw you away in a heartbeat, Imelda, like the piece of shite you are.
I knew the look on her face, the slack jaw, the blind black eyes stretched too wide to blink. I'd seen it on my ma 100 times, in the second when she knew she was about to get hit. I didn't care. The thought of the back of my hand cracking across Imelda's mouth almost choked me with how badly I wanted it.
You didn't mind opening your ugly yap for anyone else who asked. Now, by Jesus, you're gonna open it for me. Who'd you tell about me and Rosie? Who, Imelda? Who was it? Was it your slut ma? Who the fuck did you...
I could already hear her spitting it at me like great slimy gobs of poison. Your Alco da, your filthy, dirty whoremaster da. And I was all ready and braced for it to hit me, when her mouth opened wide and red, and she almost howled into my face.
I told your brother! Bullshit, you lying bitch! That's the crap you fed Scorcher Kennedy and he lapped it up. But do I look as stupid as him, do I? Not Kevin, you thick bastard! What would I be doing with Kevin? Shay! I told Shay!
The room went soundless. A huge, perfect silence like snowfall, as if there had never been a noise in all the world. After what might have been a long time, I noticed that I was sitting in the armchair again, and that I was numb all over, like my blood had stopped moving. After a while longer, I noticed that someone upstairs had a washing machine on. Imelda had shrunk into the sofa cushions. The terror on her face told me what mine must look like. I said, "What did you tell him?"
"Francis, I'm sorry, right? I didn't think..."
"What did you tell him, Imelda?"
"Just... you and Rosie. That yous were heading off."
"When did you say it to him?"
"The Saturday night. In the pub. The night before yous were leaving. I thought, sure, what harm at that stage? It was too late for anyone to stop yous."
Three girls leaning on the railings and tossing their hair, glossy and restless as wild fillies, fidgeting on the edge of their anything-can-happen evening. Apparently, just about anything had. I said, "If you give me one more shitty excuse, I'm gonna put my foot through that Rob Telly." Imelda shut up. I said, "Did you tell him when we were going?" A quick jerk of a nod. "And where you'd left the suitcase?"
"Yeah. Not what room, like, just... in number 16.
The dirty white winter light through the lace curtains was vicious on her. Slumped in the corner of the sofa, in this overheated room that stank of grease and cigarettes and waste, she looked like an underfilled bag of bones wrapped in grey skin.
I couldn't think of one thing this woman could have wanted that would have been worth what she had thrown away. I said, "Why, Imelda? Why the hell?" She shrugged. It dawned on me in a slow wave, with a faint red stain mottling her cheeks. "You've got to be kidding me," I said. "You were into Shay." Another shrug, this one sharper and pricklier. "Those bright-coloured girls shrieking and play-fighting. Mandy said to ask if your brother fancies going to the pictures." I said, "I thought Mandy was the one who had a thing for him."
"Her too. We all did. Not Rosie, but loads of us. He had his pick."
"And so you sold Rosie out to get his attention. Is that what you had in mind when you told me you loved her?"
"That's not bleeding fair. I never meant to."
I fired the ashtray at the telly. It was heavy, and I put my whole body behind it. It smashed through the screen with an impressive crashing noise and an explosion of ash and butts and splinters of glass. Imelda let out something between a gasp and a yelp and cringed away from me, one forearm thrown up to protect her face. Specks of ash filled up the air, whirled and settled on the carpet, the coffee table, her tracksuit bottoms. "Now," I said, "what did I warn you?" She shook her head, wild-eyed. She had a hand pressed over her mouth. Someone had trained her not to scream. I flicked away glittering speckles of glass and found Imelda's smokes on the coffee table under a ball of green ribbon. "You're gonna tell me what you said to him, word for word, as close as you can remember. Don't leave anything out. If you can't remember something for definite, say so. Don't make shit up. Is that clear?" Imelda nodded, hard, into her palm. I lit a smoke and leaned back in the armchair. "Good," I said. "So talk." I could have told the story myself. The pub was some place off Wexford Street. Imelda didn't remember the name. "We were going dancing, me and Mandy and Julie. But Rosie had to be home early. Her dad was on the warpath. So she didn't want to pay into the disco. So we said we'd go for a few pints first." Imelda had been up at the bar, getting her round in, when she spotted Shay. She'd got chatting to him. I could see her, tossing her hair, jutting one hip, slagging him off. Shay had flirted back automatically, but he liked them prettier and softer, and a lot less mouthy. And when his pints arrived, he had gathered them up and turned to head back to his mates in their corner. She had just been trying to keep his attention. "What's wrong, Shay? Is Francis right? Yeah. Are you more into the fellas?"
"Look who's talking," he'd said. "When was the last time that little prick had a girlfriend?" And he had started to move off.
Imelda had said, "That's all you know." That had stopped him.
"Yeah?
The lads are waiting on their pints. Go on. Off you go."
"I'll be back in a sec. You just hang on there."
"I might, or I might not." Of course she'd waited for him. Rosie laughed at her when she dropped the drinks down to them in a rush, and Mandy faked an outraged sniff, "Robbin' my fella." But Imelda gave them the finger and hurried back up to the bar in time to be lounging there, all casual and sipping her glass of lager and one button undone, when Shay got back. Her heart was going 90. He had never looked twice at her before. He bent his head close and gave her the intense blue gaze that never let him down, slouched on a bar stool and slid one of his knees in between hers, bought her the next drink and ran a finger over her knuckles when he passed it to her. She spun the story out as long as she could, to keep him with her. But in the end, the whole plan was spread out on the bar between them. The suitcase, the meeting place, the boat, the London bedsit, the music business jobs, the tiny wedding. Every secret thing Rosie and I had spent months building up, fragment by fragment, and keeping safe and precious next to our skin. Imelda felt like shite about doing it. She couldn't even stand to look over at Rosie, cracking up laughing with Mandy and Julie over something or other. 22 years later, and the colour still flamed up in her cheeks when she talked about it. She had done it anyway. It was such a pathetic little story. A snip of nothing. The kind teenage girls fight over and forget every day. It had led us to this week, and this room. "Tell me," I said. "Did he at least throw you a quick fuck after all that?" Imelda wasn't looking at me, but the red patches deepened. "Oh, good. I'd hate to think you went to the hassle of selling me and Rosie down the river. All for nothing." "This way, yeah. Two people ended up dead, and a big bunch of lives ended up getting blown to smithereens, but hey, at least you got the ride you were after." She said, in a thin, stretched voice, "You mean, me saying it to Shay? Did that get Rosie killed?" "You're a fucking genius."
"Francis, did..."
Imelda shuddered all over, like a spooked horse.
"Did Shay..."
"Did I say that?" She shook her head. "Well spotted. Pay attention, Imelda. If you go spreading that shite around, if you say it to even one person, you will regret it for the rest of your life. You've done your best to wreck one of my brother's name. I'm not having you wreck the other."
"I'll say nothing to anyone. I swear, Francis."
"That includes your daughters, just in case squealing runs in the family." She flinched. "You never talked to Shay, and I was never here. Have you got me?"
"Yeah." "Francis. I'm sorry. God, I'm so sorry. I never once thought..."
I said, "Look what you did." It was the only thing that would come out of my mouth.
"Sweet Jesus, Imelda, look what you did."
And I left her there, staring at ash and broken glass and nothing. Chapter 19. That night lasted a long time. I almost rang my lovely lady friend from the tech bureau, but I figured few things can put a damper on a cheerful shag, quite like a partner who knows too many details about how your ex died. I thought about going to the pub, but there was no point unless I was planning to get mouldy drunk, which struck me as a truly lousy idea. I even thought, a lot, about ringing Olivia and asking if I could come over, but I figured I'd probably pushed my luck far enough that week. I ended up at Ned Kelly's on O'Connell Street, playing game after game of backroom pool with three Russian guys who didn't speak much English, but who could spot the international signs of a man in need. When Ned's closed up, I went home and sat in my balcony, chain-smoking, till my arse started to freeze, at which point I went inside and watched delusional white boys make rapper hand signs at each other on some reality show, until it got light enough that I could eat breakfast. Every few minutes, I tried to hit that mental switch hard enough that I wouldn't see Rosie's face, or Kevin's, or Shay's. It wasn't Kev all grown up I kept seeing. It was the sticky-faced kid who had shared a mattress with me for so long that I could still feel his feet tucked between my shins to keep warm in winter. He'd been the prettiest of us by a mile, a chubby, blonde angel off a serial ad. Carmel and her mates used to haul him around like a rag doll, changing his clothes and shoving sweets in his mouth, and practicing to be mammies someday. He would lie back in their dolly prams with a big, happy grin on his face, lapping up the attention. Even at that age, our Kev had loved the ladies. I hoped someone had told his multiple girlfriends, and had been gentle about it, why he wouldn't be coming over anymore. And it wasn't Rosie shining with first love and big plans who kept sliding into my mind. It was Rosie angry. An autumn evening, when we were 17, Carmel and Shay and me smoking on the steps. Carmel smoked back then, and she let me bum off her during school terms when I wasn't working and couldn't afford my own. The air smelled of peat smoke, mist, and Guinnesses, and Shay was whistling, "Take Me Up to Monto," softly to himself between his teeth. Then the shouting started. It was Mr. Daly, and he was going apeshit. The details got lost, but the gist of it was that he wouldn't be crossed under his own roof, and that someone was going to get the back of his hand in a minute if she wasn't careful. My insides turned into one solid lump of ice. Shay said, "A quid says he caught his missus riding some young fella." Carmel clicked her tongue. "Don't be filthy," I said, keeping my voice casual. "You're on." We'd been going out for a little over a year, me and Rosie. Our mates knew, but we played it down, to keep the word from spreading too far. Just having a laugh, just messing, nothing serious. That felt more like bollocks to me every week. But Rosie said her dad wouldn't be happy, and she said it like she meant it. Part of me had spent the last year waiting for this evening to kick me in the teeth. "You haven't got a quid."
"Won't need it."
Windows were sliding open already. The Dalys fought less than just about anyone in the place, so this was high-quality scandal. Rosie yelled, "You haven't a bleeding clue!" I got one last drag out of my smoke, down to the filter. "Quid," I said to Shay. "You'll get it when I get paid." Rosie flung herself out of number three, slammed the door hard enough that the nosy biddies shot back into their lairs to enjoy being shocked in private, and headed our way. Against the grey autumn day, her hair looked like it was about to set the air on fire and blow the whole place sky high. Shay said,
"How are you, Rosie? Looking gorgeous, as always."
"And you look like a bag of spanners, as always. Francis, can I have a word?"
Shay whistled. Carmel's mouth was open. I said, "Yeah, sure," and got up. "We'll go for a walk, will we?" The last thing I heard behind me, as we turned the corner onto Smith's Road, was Shay's dirtiest laugh. Rosie had her hands jammed deep in the pockets of her jeans jacket, and she was walking so fast I could hardly keep up. She said, biting off the words, "My da found out." I had known that was coming, but my stomach hit my shoes anyway. Ah, shite. I thought that all right.
How?
When we were in Neary's, I should have known it wasn't safe. My cousin Shirley and her mates drink there, and she's a mouth on her the size of a church door. The little cow sauce. She told her ma told my ma, and my ma bleeding well told my da. And he went ballistic. Rosie exploded.
The bastard! The bloody bastard! Next time I see Shirley, I'm going to splatter her! He didn't listen to a word I said! Might as well have been talking to the wall!
Rosie, slow down.
He said not to come crying to him when I wound up pregnant and dumped and covered in bruises. Jesus, Frank, I could have killed him. I swear to God.
Then what are you doing here?
Does he know?
Rosie said,
"Yeah, he does.
He sent me round to break it off with you." I didn't even realize I had stopped in the middle of the pavement till she turned back to see where I'd gone.
"I'm not doing it, you big idiot. You seriously think I'd leave you because my dad told me to? Are you mental?"
"Christ," I said. My heart slowly slid back down to where it belonged. "Are you trying to give me a heart attack?" I thought, "Christ."
"Francis."
She came back to me and laced her fingers through mine, hard enough to hurt.
"I'm not, okay? I just don't know what to do."
I would have sold a kidney to be able to come out with the magic answer. I went for the most impressive dragon-slaying offer I could think of. "I'll call in and talk to your da, man to man. I'll tell him there's no way I'd mess you around."
"I already told him that 100 times. He thinks you're after selling me a load of bollocks so you can get into my knickers, and I'm after buying every word. You think he'll listen to you when he won't to me?"
"So I'll show him. Once he sees I'm treating you right."
"We don't have time. He says I'm to break it off with you tonight, or he'll throw me out of the house, and he will, he'll do it."
"It'd break Mammy's heart, but he wouldn't care.
He'll tell her she can't even see me again, and, God help her, she'll do what she's told."
After 17 years of my family, my default solution to everything was a tightly zipped lip. I said, "So tell him you did it. Dumped me. Nobody has to know we're still together." Rosie went motionless, and I saw her mind start to move fast. After a moment she said, "For how long?" "Till we come up with a better plan. Till your dad chills out, I don't know. If we just hang in there long enough, something's bound to change." "Maybe." She was still thinking hard, head bent over our joined hands. "Do you think we could pull it off? The way people talk around here." I said, "I'm not saying it'd be easy. We'll have to tell everyone we're after breaking up and make it sound good. We won't be able to go to the Debs together. You'll always be worrying that your dad'll find out and throw you out."
"I don't give a damn."
"What about you, though? You don't need to be sneaking around. Your dad isn't trying to make you into a nun. Is it worth it?" I said, "What are you on about? I love you." It stunned me. I'd never said it before. I knew that I would never say it again, not really. That you only get one shot at it in a lifetime. I got mine out of nowhere on a misty autumn evening, under a street lamp shining yellow streaks on the wet pavement, with Rosie's strong, pliable fingers woven through mine. Rosie's mouth opened. She said, "Oh!" It came out on something like a wonderful, helpless, breathless laugh. "There you go," I said. She said, "Well then," in another burst of almost laughter. "Then it's all okay, isn't it?"
"Is it?"
"Yeah. I love you too. So we'll find a way. Am I right?" I was out of words. I couldn't think of anything to do except pull her tight against me. An owl fella walking his dog dodged around us and muttered something about shocking carry-on. But I couldn't have moved if I'd wanted to. Rosie pressed her face hard into the angle of my neck. I felt her eyelashes flicker against my skin, and then wetness where they had been. "We will," I said, into her warm hair. And I knew for certain it was true, because we were holding the trump card, the wild joker that beat everything else in the pack. "We'll find a way." We went home. Once we had walked and talked ourselves exhausted, to start the careful, crucial process of convincing the place we were history. Late that night, in spite of the long, cunning wait we had planned, we met in number 16. We were way beyond caring how dangerous the timing was. We lay down together on the creaking floorboards, and Rosie wrapped us chest to chest in the soft blue blanket she always brought with her. And that night she never said, "Stop." That evening was one of the reasons it had never occurred to me that Rosie could be dead. The blaze of her, when she was that angry. You could have lit a match by touching it to her skin. You could have lit up Christmas trees. You could have seen her from space. For all that to have vanished into nothing, gone for good, was unthinkable. Danny Matches would burn down the bike shop and arrange all the evidence artistically to point straight to Shay, if I asked him nicely. Alternatively, I knew several guys who made Danny look like a cream puff, and who would do a beautiful job, complete with whatever level of pain I required, of making sure none of Shay's component parts were ever seen again. The problem was that I didn't want Danny Matches, or the Bolt Gun Brigade, or anyone else. Scorcher was right off the menu. If he needed Kevin for his bad guy that much, he could have him. Olivia was right. Nothing anyone said could hurt Kev now. And justice had slid way down my Christmas wish list. All I wanted in the world was Shay. Every time I looked out over the Liffey, I saw him at his window, somewhere in that tangle of lights, smoking and staring back across the river, and waiting for me to come find him. I had never wanted any girl, not even Rosie, as badly as I wanted him. Friday afternoon, I texted Stephen. Same time, same place. It was raining, thick, sleety rain that soaked through everything you were wearing and chilled you down to the bone. Cosmos was packed with wet, tired people counting shopping bags and hoping if they stayed put long enough they would get warm. This time, I only ordered coffee. I already knew this wasn't going to take long. Stephen looked a little unsure about what we were doing there, but he was too polite to ask. Instead, he said, "Kevin's phone records haven't come in yet." I didn't think they had. "Do you know when the investigation's winding up?" "We've been told probably Tuesday. Detective Kennedy says..." "Well, he figures we've got enough evidence to make a case. From now on, we're just tidying up the paperwork." I said, "It sounds to me like you've heard about the lovely Imelda Tierney." "Well, yeah." "Detective Kennedy thinks her story is the final piece of the puzzle. Perfect fit. Now we can wrap everything up in a pretty parcel and tie it with ribbons and present it to the DPP. Am I right?"
"More or less, yeah."
"And what do you think?" Stephen rubbed at his hair, leaving it standing up in tufts. "I think," he said, "from what Detective Kennedy said, and tell me if this is wrong, I think Imelda Tierney's well pissed off with you."
"I'm not her favorite person right now, no."
"You know her, even if it's from ages ago. If she was pissed off enough, would she make up something like this?"
"I'd say she'd do it in a heartbeat.
Call me biased."
Stephen shook his head.
"Maybe I would. Only I've still got the same problem with the fingerprints as I had before. Unless Imelda Tierney can explain the note being wiped, it outweighs her story as far as I'm concerned. People lie. Evidence doesn't."
"The kid was worth 10 of Scorcher, and probably of me."
I said, "I like the way you think, Detective. Unfortunately, I'm pretty sure Scorcher Kennedy's not going to start thinking the same way anytime soon. Not unless we come up with an alternative theory that's too solid for him to ignore." He still put a shy little twist on the "we," like a teenager talking about his first girlfriend. Working with me had been a big deal to him. "So, that's what I've been concentrating on. I spent a lot of time going over this case in my head, looking for what we could have missed, and last night something hit me."
"Yeah?
What would that be?"
"Okay."
Stephen took a deep breath. He'd rehearsed this, ready to impress me. "So far, we've none of us paid any attention to the fact that Rose Daly's body was concealed, yeah? We've thought about the implications of where it was concealed, but not the fact that it was concealed to start with. And I think that should have told us something. Everyone's agreed that this looks like an unplanned crime, right? Our fella just snapped.
That's what it looks like.
So, his head must have been well wrecked once he saw what he'd done. Me, I'd have legged it out of that house as fast as I could go. Instead, our guy got up the willpower to stay put, find a hiding place, stash a heavy body under a heavy concrete slab. That took time and effort, loads of it. He needed that body hidden, like, badly.
Why?
Why not just leave her for someone to find in the morning?
He'd make a profiler yet.
I said,
"You tell me."
Stephen was leaning forward across the table, eyes fixed on mine, all wrapped up in the story. "Because he knew someone out there could link him either to Rose or to the house. Has to be. If her body had been found the next day, someone out there would have said, 'Hang on, I saw so-and-so going into number 16 last night,' or 'I think so-and-so was planning on meeting Rose Daly.' He couldn't afford to let her be found."
"Sounds about right to me."
"So, all we need to do is find that link. We're discounting Imelda's story, but someone out there has another story a lot like that one, only true. Probably they've forgotten all about it, since they never realized it was important. But if we can just jog their memory... I'd start by talking to the people who are closest to Rose. Her sister, her best friends, and the people who used to live on the even-numbered side of Faithful Place. Your statement says you heard someone going through those gardens.
He could have been seen out a back window. A few more days working along these lines, and he was going to get somewhere. He looked so hopeful. I hated to smack the poor little bastard down. It was like kicking a half-grown retriever who had brought me his best chew toy. But it needed doing. I said, "Good thinking, detective. That all hangs together very nicely. Now leave it." Blank stare. "What? What do you mean, like?" "Stephen, why do you think I texted you today? I knew you wouldn't have the phone records for me. I already knew about Imelda Tierney. I was pretty sure you would have been in touch if something momentous had happened. Why did you think I wanted to meet up?"
"I just figured... updates."
"You could call it that. Here's the update. From now on, we're leaving this case to its own devices. I'm back on my holidays, and you're back on typist duty. Enjoy." Stephen's coffee cup went down with a flat bang.
"What? Why?
Did your mother ever tell you, because I said so?"
"You're not my mother. What the hell?"
Then he stopped in mid-sentence as the light bulb went on.
"You've found something," he said, "haven't you? Last time when you legged it out of here, something had hit you. You chased it for a couple of days and now..."
I shook my head. "Another cute theory, but no. I'd have loved this case to solve itself in a blinding flash of inspiration. But I hate to break it to you, they just don't do that as often as you think.
And now that you've got it, you're keeping it to yourself. Bye-bye, Stephen. Thanks for playing. Now get back in your box. I suppose I should be flattered that you're worried about me catching up, should I?"
I sighed, leaned back in my chair and kneaded at the back of my neck. "Kid, if you don't mind hearing one little piece of advice from someone who's been doing this job a lot longer than you have, let me share this secret with you. With almost no exceptions, the simplest explanation is the right one. There's no cover-up, there's no big conspiracy, and the government has not planted a chip behind your ear. The only thing I found out over the last couple of days is that it's time for you and me to let this case go." Stephen was staring at me like I'd grown an extra head.
"Hang on a minute here. What happened to us having a responsibility to the victims? What happened to, it's just you and me, we're all they've got?"
I said, "It got pointless, kid. That's what happened. Scorcher Kennedy's right. He's got a beauty of a case. If I were the DPP, I'd give him the go-ahead in a heartbeat. There's no way in hell he's going to ditch his whole theory and start from scratch, even if the angel Gabriel comes down from heaven to tell him he's got it wrong. Never mind because something a little funny shows up on Kevin's phone records, or because you and I think Imelda's story smells icky. It doesn't matter what happens between now and Tuesday. This case is over."
"And you're okay with that?"
"No, sunshine, I'm not. I'm not one little bit okay with it. But I'm a grown-up. If I'm going to throw myself in front of a bullet, it's going to be for something where that might possibly make a difference. I don't do lost causes, no matter how romantic, because they're a waste. Just like it would be a waste for you to get reverted to uniform and booted to a backwoods desk job for the rest of your career because you got caught leaking useless info to me." The kid had a redhead's temper. One fist was clenched on the table, and he looked like he was about ready to plant it in my face.
"That's my decision. I'm a big boy, I'm well able to look after myself."
I laughed. "Don't fool yourself. I'm not trying to protect you. I would happily get you to keep putting your career on the line through 2012, never mind through next Tuesday, if I thought for one second it would do any good. But it wouldn't. You wanted me to get involved here. You practically shoved me into it. And now I'm involved and I'm staying that way. You don't get to keep changing your mind every few days. Fetch the stick, Stephen. Drop the stick, Stephen. Fetch the stick, Stephen. I'm not your bitch any more than I'm Detective Kennedy's."
"Actually," I said, "you are. I'm going to be keeping an eye on you, Stevie, my friend. And if I get just one hint that you're still poking your nose where it doesn't belong, I'm going to take that post-mortem report and that fingerprint report to Detective Kennedy and tell him where I got them. Then you'll be in his bad books, you'll be in my bad books, and, more than likely, you'll be at that desk in the arsehole of nowhere. So, I'm telling you one more time, back off. Do you get that?"
Stephen was too stunned and too young to keep his face under control. He was staring at me with a naked, blazing mix of fury, amazement, and disgust. This was exactly what I was aiming for. The snotter he got with me, the further he would be from the various forms of nasty that were coming up. But somehow, it still stung.
"Man," he said, shaking his head, "I don't get you. I really don't."
I said, "Ain't that the truth?" and started fishing for my wallet.
"And I don't need you buy me coffee. I can pay my own way."
If I kicked him in the ego too hard, he might keep chasing the case just to prove to himself that he still had a pair.
"Your choice," I said. "And Stephen."
He kept his head down, rummaging in his pockets. "Detective, I'm gonna need you to look at me." I waited till he cracked and reluctantly met my eyes before I said,
"You've done some excellent work here. I know this isn't how either of us wanted it to end, but all I can tell you is that I'm not going to forget it. When there's something I can do for you, and there will be, I'm going to be all over it. Like I said, I can pay my own way.
I know you can, but I like paying my debts too, and I owe you."
"It's been a pleasure working with you, Detective. I look forward to doing it again."
I didn't try to shake hands. Stephen shot me a dark look that gave away nothing, slapped a tenner onto the table, which counted as a serious gesture from someone on newbie wages, and shrugged on his coat. I stayed where I was, and let him be the one who walked away. And there I was, back where I had been just a week before, parking in front of Liv's place to pick Holly up for the weekend. It felt like it had been years. Olivia was wearing a discreet, caramel-coloured number instead of last week's discreet little black dress, but the message was the same. Dermo the pseudo-pedo was on his way, and he was in with a chance. This time, though, instead of barricading the door, she opened it wide and drew me quickly into the kitchen. Back when we were married, I used to dread Liv's we-need-to-talk signals, but at this stage I actually welcomed them. They beat her I've-got-nothing-to-say-to-you routine, hands down. I said, "Holly not ready, no?"
"She's in the bath. It was a bring-a-friend day at Sarah's hip-hop class. She just got home, all sweaty. She'll be a few minutes."
"How's she doing?"
Olivia sighed, ran a hand lightly over her immaculate hairdo.
"I think she's all right. All right as we could expect, anyway. She had a nightmare last night, and she's been quiet. But she doesn't seem... I don't know. She loved the hip-hop class."
I said, "Is she eating?" When I moved out, Holly went on hunger strike for a while.
"Yes, but she's not five anymore. She's not always as obvious about her feelings these days.
That doesn't mean they're not there.
Would you try talking to her? Maybe you can get a better sense of how she's coping."
"So she's keeping stuff to herself," I said. Nowhere near as nastily as I could have. "I wonder where she got that idea." The corners of Olivia's lips tightened up.
"I made a mistake, a bad one. I've admitted that and apologized for it. And I'm doing my utmost to fix the damage. Believe me, there's nothing you could say that would make me feel any worse about hurting her."
I pulled out one of the bar stools and parked my arse heavily, not to piss Olivia off this time, just because I was wrecked enough that even a 2-minute sit-down in a room that smelled of toast and strawberry jam felt like a big treat.
"People hurt each other. That's how it works. At least you were trying to do something good. Not everyone can say as much."
The tightness had spread down to Liv's shoulders. She said,
"People don't necessarily hurt each other."
"Yes, Liv. They do. Parents. Lovers, brothers and sisters, you name it. The closer you get, the more damage you do."
"Well, sometimes yes, of course. But talking like it's some unavoidable law of nature, that's a cop-out, Frank, and you know it.
Let me pour you a nice, cold, refreshing glass of reality. Most people are only too delighted to wreck each other's heads. And for the tiny minority who do their pathetic best not to, this world is going to go right ahead and make sure they do it anyway."
"Sometimes," Olivia said coldly, "I really wish you could hear yourself. You sound like a teenager. Do you realize that? A self-pitying teenager with too many Morrissey albums.
It was an exit line. Her hand was on the